Hi, Future Ben here. Just jumping on really quickly to let you know that we've got a listener feedback survey live right now, and we'd really appreciate if you took 2 minutes to fill it out and let us know what you're thinking about We Speak Common. There's a link in the description of this episode, but you can also find it by heading to our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages. And if you're a Patreon member, there'll be a link posted on the Discord server. The survey's live until the 2nd of December. Thanks! This week, I'm joined by Ray to talk about player setting guides, what you need to put in them, and what you need to communicate to your players to give them the best starting point in your games. Welcome to We Speak Common. Hello, and welcome to a brand new episode of the D&D Podcast for Everyone. Because here we speak common. This is a show brought to you in partnership with The Dice Dungeon. Get yourself 10% off your entire order of lovely, pristine and premium dice with the code WESPEAKCOMMON at checkout. We're also brought to you in partnership with Describe, your one-stop shop for creatively written box text for your homebrew games. You can subscribe with 10% off every month with the code COMMON at checkout. And this month brought to you in partnership with Manscaped. Get your jewels, the tools for the job. 20% off, free worldwide shipping, when you use the code COMMON at checkout. As ever, we'll talk about our sponsors and our partners a little bit later in the show. But right now, I'm joined by Mr. Ray. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Ben. Thanks for having me here.
Hey, no problem. No problem at all. What is life treating you? How is it treating you at the moment?
It's going pretty good. No news is good news, as they say.
That sounds slightly ominous, but okay.
Are you waiting for news? Yeah. Oftentimes that when you have news, when someone asks you what's going on in your life, I feel like it's often bad news. So no news is, we should celebrate when we have no news to share, is what I think.
Yeah. I think that's painted you as a glass half empty type of person.
Oh no, but that's not me. Okay. I'll share some personal information. So Melissa and I are planning our wedding. That's very exciting. Mm-hmm. And yeah, playing D&D. So life just can't be that bad.
Yeah, that's good. I'll take that. I'll take that a lot. And yeah, if you're managing to get, as we have been talking about, if you're managing to get D&D in there somewhere, things must be going kind of all right at the very least.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'm a little bit wary today, a little bit ropey. I'm not very well, so you'll have to bear with me. But I think I've managed to save up every modicum of energy that I have for this conversation and this conversation alone. So we'll smash it. We're going to talk about setting guides today, right? And
all right.
I think there's, I want to talk about like defining that first. So because we talk about setting guides, and often people think of like books like, what's it called? Explorer's Guide to Wildemount or Eberron Rising from the Last War, which are like, here's a setting and here's absolutely everything you need to know. We're not talking about that type of setting guide. We're going to talk about like a player setting guide. So for example, and the best example I can think of.
Are you going to talk about Odyssey of the Dragonlords?
Yeah, I'm hoping a lot of people have seen this. So Odyssey of the Dragonlords came out a while ago, actually, but it released obviously the campaign and the book, which has its own setting, but it also released a player's guide, which is a paperback book that has all of the kind of information that the players will need in it for being characters in that world. So the kind of stuff that you'd need to know if you lived there, you know, how laws work. Think of things like in Waterdeep Dragon Heist, you get the code legal, stuff like that. There's the bit at the back of that book. I always forget what it's called and I always say it wrong when I remember, but it's like written by Volo and it's the thing that you can just give to the players to read.
The Gazette.
I don't know if it is actually called a Gazette in Dragon Heist. I think it's called something else, but yeah, effectively a Gazette. Think of that kind of booklet or that kind of piece of content. That's what we're talking about today. When you create something to give to your players, to give them what they need to play in that world. That's what we're getting into.
I think that's a really good way of framing it. And a way that I had not thought about it before. So I'm making my own setting, as lots of DMs do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I had not considered looking at my copy of the Odyssey of the Dragonlords player handout and making sure that I had a version of that for my game. But now that you say it, it seems so obvious, and I think that's exactly what I'm going to do. Yeah, I guess I had not imagined that there was some in-between between kind of like the Explorer's Guide to Wildemount, where for a player to like really be able to act with confidence in this setting, they either need to have read that entire book or they need to have watched Critical Role, many episodes of Critical Role.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're going to get into, because there is that kind of thing of, okay, let me organize my words in my brain. We're going to talk about, I think, at first, the kind of how, why, and when, and then in the latter half of this episode, that go into more detail of like what you might share particularly and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the time when people, it tends to be homebrew campaign settings, right? Because like I'm making a homebrew setting too. I have been for years. And at some point I'll put my players back into it. They've been in it once. And I think that the go-to is, oh, they'll learn everything as they play, which is great. And there should absolutely be stuff that people learn when they play. But there also needs to be that kind of, like with a character, you have a cornerstone, you have their backstory. You kind of need that with the world too.
I think that for a new DM, it can be really tempting to run in a homebrew campaign setting, because that's one of the promises of Dungeons and Dragons, that you get to create your own world and then your players get to experience it. People always say, don't run in your homebrew setting, like for the first time, like just run a module, run the starter set, because you're going to learn so much that you can then bring back to that homebrew setting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is, we're kind of like putting to words something that has always just kind of like existed ambiguously, which is this idea that a huge boon that you get from running in the default fantasy land setting is that your players are walking into this world kind of already knowing what to expect. If they've experienced any of Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, they are already steeped in what is possible in this campaign setting, and it allows them to act with confidence in the world. It allows them to do things rather than asking the DM first before they do anything, if that's how it works in this world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're probably going to be talking about homebrew settings mostly here and in that framing, but there is a place for this in pre-published settings, I think, particularly if you are bringing a party of players into a setting they've not been in before. So, you know, my group of players, they know Faerun. They've been playing in it for, you know, a decade. If I were to next year say, okay, we're going to play a new game and we're going to play it in Eberron, and, you know, I know that maybe one player has read about Eberron and the rest don't, I would probably then start implementing this kind of tactic to get them prepped to play in that game. So this stuff is relevant for published settings when your players have never been in them before, have never read them. But we will probably talk mostly about homebrew here, because I think that's where it applies 9 times out of 10.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, good. I'm glad we're on the same page.
So, I disagree.
No, you're wrong. Everyone knows everything. Okay, let's talk about exactly what a player's guide is then. I think maybe that is a better name from it than setting guide. What is a player's guide?
Yeah, and how is it different from what a DM would just deliver in a session zero, where they're kind of trying to like tell their player what their game is going to be about?
So the player guide should, and interesting you bring up session zeros, because I think the player guide should basically bolster everything that you set up in a session zero. When you're sat in a group talking about like, okay, here's my world, here's kind of what it's like, inevitably there are going to be things you miss off, or there's going to be things they forget because you're just talking. When you then give them the player's guide, they should be able to look through it and say, oh, here's that thing that Ben mentioned, and here it is in more detail, and actually kind of by law how it works. Like, this is exactly what it is. This isn't a dumbed down, oh, it kind of works like this. This is exactly how it works. It's the grit of what you set up in the session zero. So for me, it's here's a brief history of the world as a character in the world would understand. So from a character in Faerun's point of view, here is how the gods work. Here is the creation myth. And here is a brief history of important things that have happened over the last X many years, depending on, you know, how old your setting is effectively. Then it would be things like, after the history, here is where the world is now. So, you know, if you're playing in a campaign where it was old fantasy, you know, standard fantasy, but at some point in history, you've said they've discovered electricity. Okay, so here's what the world looks like now. And draw parallels. You know, it's kind of like Faerun, except they have cars. Like, you know, like, draw that parallel, give them something to go off of. Set an idea of exactly what the world looks like when they're in it. And that includes things like, here's the king, here's who the king is, and here's who the ruling body is, and here's the group of rogues that run riot in the village that the campaign's the city that the campaign's going to be set in, that you would know, like, you know of the Xanathar's Guild, everybody knows of them. So put that stuff in so that they've got a good idea of, okay, here's basic world knowledge that my character will always have. Anything extra that the character might have from a background, if they are a member of the Xanathar's Guild and so they know where all the tunnels are, that stuff you talk about with in their character creation. That doesn't go in the player's guide. That's not general knowledge. That's specific knowledge. And then from that point on, and this would apply more to homebrew stuff, if you've got special mechanics or, like, you know, okay, we're going to have a stress score in this game. Okay, in this game, we're going to have luck. Everybody's going to have a luck score, you know, stuff like that. If you're putting that stuff in, that then goes at the back of the book, and it's here's, you know, the mechanic, here's how it works, here's how it will affect you, here's what you need to know to be able to make informed decisions with this mechanic going forward. Because that stuff is stuff that if it was written in the game, it would be in the player's handbook and they'd have it anyway. And I think that's probably, for me, the three areas: past, present, mechanics. Fair play.
That's it.
I think at its most basic, yeah.
All that is to say is, if someone's listening to this and they're like, that sounds like a lot of work.
Like, yes.
You're super right. Like, this is a lot of work, which is why it's way easier to avoid most of this, in my opinion. I think that this is a tool that you reach for when you're trying to run a very deliberate game of Dungeons and Dragons. You want it to have a very specific feel. You want there to be specific tones. You want the characters to kind of, like, have a specific feeling quality to them. Otherwise, I think it's sufficient to kind of get the kind of, like, the smattering of characters and factions and stories and tones that you get when you kind of just tell people to show up with a character, and you don't give them guidance.
Yeah, well, I think, like, because if I think about running Waterdeep, because I think Waterdeep's a good example of where factions get used, so Dragonheist particularly, when we played that game in the session zero, I said, look, here's the rules, here's the lore, here's how it works, this is going to matter here, and I will give you a copy of that. So that, in this sense, is like the player guide. And I said, you know, the city is made up of wards, it's made up of all these different factions, and I'm going to give you a document that tells you about all those factions. And that's what they give you at the back of Waterdeep Dragon Heist. It says, okay, in the city, you will come up against the Xanathar's Guild, the Emerald Enclave, the Watchful Order of Mages and Protectors. Like, you know, you'll come up against these names that are going to come up. So here's a paragraph, and that paragraph can be four sentences, just an idea of what they are. Like, the Emerald Enclave, they are mostly druids. They also have wizards and people who want to protect the natural order of things. They're in the city trying to make sure that the wildlife and the open park spaces get cared for and looked after. They're also good guys who will help fight evil. Like, sorted, done. And then if the player comes to me and says, oh, I'm making a druid, I'd really like to, like, join that faction, I go, cool, here's the extra stuff you need to know. And then I go into detail with them.
I really like that. Really kind of section off your exposition. and give it to the people who ask for it. Mm-hmm. Because I think that you'll find that a lot of your players, even players that are taking your game very seriously, are daunted by the idea of, oh, and I got to memorize this, like, these three pages of content. It's definitely an interesting balance to strike, and a really good technique to, like, not ask too much of your players is to section off that knowledge the way that you have.
Yeah, and I think if players want it, they'll come and ask for it. Because, like, I know for me, when I'm making a character, I want to root it into the world, because that helps me make decisions and like play that character and tell stories and things. So I want to know, oh, I'm making a character that's lived in the city his whole life. Give me, like, how I would feel about the city. Like, what's the general, like, how do people feel about the way it's being run? Would I like that? Would I not like that? Is it totalitarian, or is it, you know, really free and a great place to live? Like, I want to know that stuff. I don't want to make that up and then come into the session and be like, yeah, my character hates the law. And then the DM's like, no, everyone actually is, it's a time of peace and prosperity. Everyone's actually really happy. Because then that's not going to work, right? It's a collaborative storytelling experience. That's what we always say. So you have to be on the same page. And then there'll be characters or players who will say, I'm making a character who's from far away. They've got the Outlander background. They don't know anything about the city, and they're going to learn it as they go. And if that's what they want to play, then great. Awesome. You don't need to give them shit tons of info, because they're going to learn it as they play.
You said something that I thought was very interesting, that I don't disagree with. I just think it was very interesting, where you say one player shows up and they say, my character hates the law. Right. And then you say, well, that doesn't really make sense with the setting, because most people are pretty happy right now. It's a time of peace and prosperity. Most people think that the people who work in government are really just trying to do their best, and things are pretty good. Like, there really isn't much poverty in this area of the world, at least. And then you followed up with, it's a collaborative storytelling experience. But the sentence before, you said no to a player who had this idea of what they wanted their character to be. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those two things are contradictory, even though they sound like it, because you followed up by saying you got to make sure you're all on the same page. And I think that this idea of saying no some of the time absolutely is a collaborative experience. Like, putting restrictions on everyone's creativity is something that we do in creative exploits all the time. When someone comes in to paint a pointillism painting, they don't then not use pointillism because it's limiting their creativity. No, it's by putting that constraint on your creativity, it forces you to become more creative. It's why we see that in improv comedy, lots of these shows follow very strict act structures. And that those restrictions then free everybody to be creative in very specific but aligned ways.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, like, I have always seen that conversation of, like, okay, when do you say no? But it's that thing of, before you've said no, everyone will have agreed what kind of game you're going to play, because it's not going to work if one player is sitting there going, oh, I really want to play a sci-fi game, and you're all there in a high fantasy game. That should have been sorted before this conversation was happening, right? And in the same sense that if a character comes to me and says, I want to hate the law, when they're making their character, I'll go, okay, what are you trying to achieve? Like, what's the character you're going for? Like, tell me your character. They'll tell me, and I'll go, yeah, okay, that could work. You'd probably be running with these circles, but it's not a, like, that's not a general consensus. So that group, like, that gang that you're going to run with, who's, like, rebellion to the current rule, they're probably going to be seen as bad guys. So just know that going in. Does that fit up with what you want? And if they're like, yes, then great. Then I'll let them play that. But if we're not having that conversation, we get to session one and they're like, I'm a good guy, I'm all about the city being prosperous, but I hate the government, I'd be like, that doesn't really track. And if we'd have had a conversation to work out how to make it track, that would have been better.
And then I think a very common pitfall you fall into in that scenario as well, where in session zero, you haven't established kind of just like the what the vibe of the group is going to be. Mm-hmm. You have that person who shows up who's like a lawful paladin. And then you have another person who shows up with their chaotic, evil warlock. And all of a sudden you have a disastrous party composition. So all this is to say is session zeros are necessary.
Yeah.
the setting guides, I think, are if you want to establish that like extra targeted tone that like when you're looking for a very deliberate story for everybody to tell together. Mm.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great segue into the when of when do you use this then? Because I think I agree with you. I think absolutely if you're going for a very specific tone, this is going to be very useful. But I think there are also times when these are useful, but it's not because you're trying to hit a tone. So like, I think the back of Waterdeep Dragon Heist is an amazing asset and you should use it at your table at session zero. You should give the players that for reading. And I think that my when is, okay, do the players have any knowledge of this world or this city? Like, this doesn't have to be I'm setting my campaign in a whole new world. It can be I'm setting my campaign in Faerun, but we're going to set it in Thay rather than on the Sword Coast, and my players know nothing about Thay. Okay, so give them a player guide that sets up what Thay is like, you know, how it's viewed by the outside world, how it's viewed inside Thay's borders, like that kind of stuff. Give them a cornerstone of reference. So the when is, have they ever been here before? Like, do they know the setting? Do they know the lore or the location, lore and setting? Do they have the information they need to make a character that makes sense here? And if they're making a character that doesn't make sense here, in the sense that they're going to make a rebellious wizard who doesn't want to be a Red Wizard of Thay and doesn't like necromancy, do they have the necessary background knowledge to make that fit and make it fun for everyone, for themselves and for the rest of the table? And is there enough info for me to tell them to give them? Like, if it's, oh, I need to tell them about this one guy, maybe that can be just done in a session zero. But if it's, okay, I need to tell them the brief history of how this guy got into power because everyone feels a little bit differently about him, then, you know, then maybe you need a guide. That's the way for me.
That makes a lot of sense. I think I have an example of a when I should have done this and I didn't, which was you guys were testing my homebrew setting maybe like a few weekends ago. Mm-hmm. And the session just didn't feel smooth. It didn't feel like a session of D&D that I would run. Excuse me, my voice.
You're getting really choked up about it.
Yeah, I'm just so sad that it didn't go well. It didn't feel like a game of session or a game of Dungeons and Dragons that I would run in my campaign with my regular players. And I was just dumping exposition onto your characters the entire game, not because I was telling all of these stories about this like lore that like I just really wanted you guys to just appreciate all the lore of my world. You guys were asking questions about things that your characters just should have known by living in the setting. And because I didn't deliver a setting guide so that you could have this information at hand and look it up basically in the setting guide as maybe one of the other characters was talking, you just needed to ask about it so that you could act, so that you could do things in the world. It was almost like you guys were actors on a stage trying to like put on an improv show, but all the lights were off and the stage was like covered in like hard, really sharp cornered furniture. And you guys were just fumbling around on the stage in the dark, banging into things. So it's like, how can you put on anything that feels good, that feels impressive, that feels like a collaborative storytelling experience?
Or that's just fun.
You don't have the tools or that's just fun. If you don't have the prerequisite, just baseline knowledge to act with confidence as a character.
Yeah. Like I wouldn't go to you and say, hey, Ray, do you want to play in The Witcher TTRPG? And you go, yeah, absolutely. But then not know anything about what a Witcher is. You know, I would say, hey, here's what a Witcher is. They're this hunter mutant person. And here's how everybody feels about them. Because if you don't know that people don't like and don't trust witches, and you go, yeah, I want to be this cool mutant monster hunter saving the day. And then you get into that game and I'm like, everybody starts throwing apples at you. You're going to be like, what the fuck's going on? This isn't what I wanted. So
right.
That communication needs to happen. And that's what a session zero is. And we're basically taking that and putting it into a nice little document that a player can take and read in their own time and digest. I think your example is really good. I remember, so like my homebrew world, when I first built it years and years ago, it started off as just a continent and we played a game in it. And I had a lot of problems then when I was like, I'm kind of just finding ways to put lore in because the guys need to know this stuff for part for the story, but it's like the creation myth of the world. Like, and at the time I was like, oh yeah, but they'll discover it as they play. But I was like, ah, the problem is that they don't know it. So they're not sure where to go next because they don't know that it links up to this thing. Whereas now, the world of Kaa, where Estroth is much bigger and there's more lore and there's more history. And I've got a point where I'm like writing up stuff that I've created. I'm like, okay, this is definitely something that the players should know going in when they make their characters. And this is something that they could find out as they play. And that's a really good place to be because I now know what cornerstones those players need to feel like they're part of the world and feel like they belong. And they're not just players running around swinging swords for no reason.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think an interesting thing that you can do with this too, it's not just a chore. You can hide the answers to riddles that have not been asked yet in this exposition that you're delivering in the setting guide. I think oftentimes as DMs, our riddles and our intrigues feel like kids riddles or kids problems because
they're really easy.
They're not just really easy. Just the way that we run Dungeons and Dragons, we usually prep session to session. Mm-hmm. It's not often that you present a riddle and you don't also present the answer to the riddle a few sentences nearby when you've presented the riddle, because the players don't live in the world. So you need to foreshadow the answer to some sort of mystery at some point. And maybe if you're especially prepared, you're able to deliver that sessions earlier in like in an exposition dump of some kind. But if you're able to hide that information in the setting guide, that's really cool because it's a cool feeling as a player because you get to remember things that you know to solve a mystery, and it feels much more rewarding than remembering what your DM said maybe like an hour ago.
So a really good example of that would be, let's say in your world, let's take a page out of Wildemount's book. You know, you've got the good gods and the bad gods and they had a war. And you have set up in the player guide, like, here are the gods that are considered as the good side, and here are the gods that are considered as the bad side, and here's all their little symbols and what they stand for. You know, this is the god of murder, this is the god of light, whatever. And so that's been given to the players. They know who these gods are, they've read the book, maybe they've built a paladin around one of the good gods, and they know that their polar opposite is God X or whatever. And so when they come across a sigil on an old wall in a dungeon and you describe it as looking like two swords crossed over, they can go as the player, I know that sigil. Where have I seen that sigil before? That's something relevant to me. Ah, that's the bad god. That's my like main bad guy. I need to investigate that, rather than them going, do I know what that means? And I go, yeah, you know that that's the sigil of God X who did X, Y, Z millions of years ago. And there's this old story that this and this happened and they fought and then the world ended and then it restarted and blah, 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 because they already know all that. It's already been said. So that's a really dumbed down, simple version but I find, for me personally, I always find it helpful when someone goes, hey, you can do X, Y, Z, but here's a really easy example of that. You can make that as complex or as, you know, simple as you want. It's that eureka moment for the players that we've talked about before in the show. Those eureka moments are like that rush of dopamine of, oh, I like what I'm doing, I like playing this game. Those moments can be had with this kind of pre-planning and this kind of lore delivery.
Absolutely. Something that also comes to mind is that you touched on is the player specific kind of exposition that you give, and the really cool feeling that you have as a player when you almost take you're almost driving in the DM seat when that exposition comes up, because you're just saying things about the world when it becomes relevant with confidence and with authority that your character would have. But the other players at the table are like in this weird situation where they're looking back and forth, like to the player and to the DM. And they're like, is he allowed to do this? Like, is this person just like riffing about like the reality of the world?
I have a great example of that in TOA. I mean, Wesley, his second character.
I don't think any of us have died twice.
No, not yet. Yeah. I mean, we've got Touchwood, we've got Game Layer. His second character is a native to the jungles of Chult, right? So when you came across this shrine, this temple that was, anyone who's played TOA will know it, it's the man with the crocodile. It's a great one. He was like, Ben, do I know what this is? And I was like, yes, you do. This is one of those fairy tales that you would have known growing up in Chult. And he goes, yes, it is. I've got it. Okay, thanks. He went and found it, and then he delivered it as his character. And he told the story of this, like this fairy tale from Chult, that if he wasn't there, if his character wasn't a member of Chult, I would have delivered through the guide NPC who's from Chult. So having him have that information as part of his character and being able to deliver it to the players adds this moment of them going, oh, this guy knows something that we don't know. Like, that's a really cool moment for both sides of the table. So that stuff is important and can be given out. It's weird. It's like, it's on topic because we're talking about setting information that you'd give out, but that is actually something I wouldn't put in the player guide. I'd give it specifically to characters like Ray. I won't say much in case anyone's listening, but you've got a backup character that's got some very specific information that only that character would know. So I wouldn't put that in the setting guide because I don't want other people knowing that.
I love this idea for anyone who's making a setting guide and they want it to be like really legit. Now we're not just talking about someone who is making this for their players. I love this idea of having specific handouts for specific factions that the players can belong to depending on their background. That just seems like a really cool handout and player resource where you get this specific handout that's for the faction that you chose off of a list, perhaps. And as a player, all of a sudden you're like, wait. Do the other players get different secret information based on the faction that they chose? This other person, they're a part of my faction also. Did they get the same handout as me? And like maybe they didn't, or maybe like the DM modified it a little bit. There's some shared information. And I love the idea almost in one of those kind of like whodunit dinner parties where you've delivered again the answer to some mystery or riddle or intrigue that will appear down the line. It's like hidden in the secret information that everybody has. And only by sharing that information over the course of the campaign do some mysteries start to become solved, or they're able to kind of like figure out some of the intrigues of your world.
Yeah. And I think that we're doing that anyway. Like when my players make characters, they don't tell each other what they're all doing. Like, you know, Ray, I've just mentioned a backup character you've got. Like, no one else knows about that character because you want it to be a surprise when that character joins the party, right? And that happens with every D&D game. Any game I play, we have a session zero. Okay, guys, if you want to share what class and maybe what race you're playing in case you don't want to double up. But I always say, you know, if there's two wizards, there's two wizards, it's fine. But share that kind of like basic so that everyone knows. But anything else you want to share is optional. If you want to keep it hidden for revealing, then keep it hidden for revealing. And in some instances, I've had that, you know, don't share the class if you really want to not share the class, but maybe give an idea of what kind of play you're going for. So that you can build a nice little party. And then privately, I have conversations with each of the players. And like, you know, Wesley might come to me and say, I really want to play a cleric, but who is like a druid. So everyone thinks he's a druid, but he's actually a cleric. And that's actually something that happened. I'm running a one-on-one game with Sam. He's a druid. It's a very druid focused story. And Wesley is guesting in that currently. And he's kind of being this mentor role for Sam's character. And he said to me, oh, so I want to be part of the Druidic Order and I want to be from this clan up in the south and all that, but I don't want to play a druid. I want to play a storm cleric, but I'm going to flavor everything as if I'm a druid. And I was like, that's perfect. That's amazing. I love that. But only Wesley and I had that conversation. So I've kind of lost my point, but I think I made it.
You did.
Okay, yes.
I forget what the point was, but you definitely hit it right out of the park.
Great. Fantastic. Perfect.
I love this. Now I don't remember what the original point was, so I'm going to go even more tangential with like random thought that I had. I think people often underestimate the power of reskinning Dungeons & Dragons material. This is something that you covered like so well with your episode of that you recorded with Treant Monk and Joe. So
which
ages ago,
like years ago. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was formative for me. Like that is one of the episodes that I remember as like one of the all time best We Speak Common episodes. So if you haven't listened to that episode, definitely go and find it. I think it was I think there's optimization is a part of the title. They were trying to convince you that optimization is not evil.
Yeah. It's the only episode we've done with Treant so far. So if you find the episode with Treant Monk, that's the one.
But this idea is that every class and race and background in D&D is just a bundle of mechanics. Mm. But Wizards of the Coast does a really good job of adding a bunch of flavor to those mechanics. So that way, someone who doesn't have that creative energy can kind of just lean into the story elements that are attached to that bundle of mechanics. But the point that Treant Monk makes, which is a great point, is like, you don't need to do that. The paladin is balanced mechanically. It's not balanced based on the fact
flavor
or story, or the fact that they're like, they follow a deity, that they're divine. Like you could have an arcane paladin, as long as you you put in the work to kind of to put it in. I think the obvious example that everybody kind of knows is if you want to be a ranger, but you don't like the ranger class features, just make a rogue and give them the Outlander background. And then boom, you have like basically everything that is necessary to be an effective ranger.
And I think that's something that came up when we played that test session with you, is I was playing a rogue, but they're a rogue scout, right? And I was like, they're a wildlife kind of person. They were like, oh, you're a rogue, are you gonna steal stuff? And I'm like, no, like, yeah, my class character sheet says rogue, but I'm not a rogue, I'm just using that class.
But then I did
steal some things, yes, because they weren't just a naturey, rangery type rogue. They were also a very sneaky, but they were a scout, so they were good at that stuff.
The party decided, like, hey, we really need to steal this thing from this person.
You're the best at it.
You have the highest stealth, lock picking, and sleight of hand stats. Mm. So go steal this thing. And you were like, shoot.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. 100%. I think the next thing to get into is the how.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Setting.
The next thing to get into is the how to do this. But before we do that, much like I stole all of that gold, I'm gonna steal your hearts by telling you all about the Dice Dungeon and their wonderful offer that they have on for Black Friday. Oh my God, Black Friday's here! It's that time of the year. Dice Dungeon are, of course, a longtime supporter of We Speak Common, and as you will know, you can get beautiful, premium, pristine dice from them. You can also get D&D books. I cannot wait to get my copy of Strixhaven from them. I have to double check with Ben that's definitely on order. But you can also get things like dice trays and spell cards and all that kind of stuff. 10% off your entire order with the code We Speak Common at checkout. But with Black Friday coming up between the 24th and the 29th of November. There is up to 50% off and random extra dice being added to orders. So put that in mind, 50% off, but you can also use the We Speak Common code on top of that to make it 60% off. So if you want to buy just for yourself a bunch of lovely dice and books and things, go for it. But also, hey, Christmas is coming. If you've got that DM or that player in your life and you want to get them a decent present, this is the place to go. They've got loads of stuff available for you. Go and check it out. Dice Dungeon, there's a link below. The code is common and Black Friday runs 24th to the 29th of November. We're also brought to you in partnership with Describe, spelled D-S-C-R-Y-B. Describe is add a .com at the end for the web address, obviously. Describe is the place to go if you're struggling with the creative writing side of storytelling, so the box text in your D&D games. And something that they're doing now, which has been asked for a long time, and now they're doing, which I'm so excited about, is they're doing player-specific box text. So up until this point, it's all been about DMs and describing stuff as you set up the scene. But now if you're playing a wizard and you want to come up with really fun ways to describe that fireball bursting out of that flaming sphere and then shrinking back down into the flaming sphere, then, you know, they've got it for you. Player-specific scenes, they include spells, attacks if you're a fighter. The stuff for DMs include locations, monsters, and casting spells from NPCs. Go and check it out. They've got, last time I checked, over 14,650 scenes, which is disgustingly ridiculous and amazing. And a bunch of them are available for free. If you want to subscribe, you can get 10% off with the code COMMON at checkout. And that's 10% off every month for the first 2 years you're subscribed. And of course, as you'll know, if you've been listening this month, support from We Speak Common is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below the waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision engineered tools for your family jewels. And they've just launched their fourth generation trimmer, which is the Lawnmower 4.0, which I've been using on my beard of all places. It's very, very good. The smaller guard works perfectly for the length that I like, and it makes me nice and soft rather than prickly and horrible. You can get 20% off and free worldwide shipping when you use the code COMMON at Manscaped. They also have their Black Friday deal coming up. Of course, there's going to be Black Friday deals kind of all over the place at the moment. So go and check that out for extra money off. I believe it's 25% off site-wide, so go and check that too. But if you haven't had a look, manscaped.com is the place to go. And of course, that code is COMMON at checkout for 20% off and free shipping worldwide. They're pretty nice trimmers. I'm not going to lie to you. They are very, very nice. Very bright light on them too, so you can really see all those crevices. Ray's looking at me, horrified and shocked on the webcam, thinking about me getting into crevices. Hey, as we like to say, every wizard needs to prepare their wand. So get to it. Make sure it's nice and clean and ready for any encounter. That's my favorite part is the awkward silence after I bring in an innuendo. That's my favorite part of that ad read.
On the topic of gifts, mm-hmm. I think that sometimes being a DM can be a thankless job. Mm. I think that sometimes your group gets really used to showing up on Saturdays and just doing it again, you know, yep. Running another session of Dungeons and Dragons. And I think you get into this weird paradox where your DM kind of is putting in all of this work and they're not really sure how much it means to the players, but then the players love the campaign. They really appreciate everything that the DM is doing, and they think that their thanks or their appreciation is kind of implicit because they've said it before in the past. They've maybe had a conversation where they're like, we love the campaign, but maybe that was months ago. Mm. One of my fondest memories that's like near and dear to my heart is that my players got me a set of dice once, just not for a holiday or anything, just as a thank you. Mm. That meant the world to me. Like, I almost cried. I was so yeah. appreciative. So if you're a player and you haven't thanked your DM in a while, you don't necessarily have to get them dice. I think that's a nice way of saying thank you. It's a nice
Black yeah. Friday and right. 10% off extra. Yeah.
But definitely no, thank thank your DM somehow, even if it's just words.
Totally right. I think there's players in my group who check in with me after every single session, and it means a lot, because I as well I'm a perfectionist, and I also worry a lot about like whether people actually enjoy the session. So to have someone say at the end of a session, "That was really good, thank you so much," means the world. And I always say, you know, as a player, for every hour you put in, the DM is putting in like 3 minimum. So, you know, it's worth just remembering that. Yeah. Spot on.
And they put in that work because they love to put in that work too. It's not just purely like
a
selfless gift. Yeah. But it just showing the appreciation is nice. And then DMs to your players as well. If you have like great players are not easy to come by. So definitely send that thanks back in their direction as well.
100%. Okay, so player guides, the how. The first thing I want to say is we've talked about a lot of different things and how to do them. And like you said, oh, that sounds like a lot and things like that. This doesn't have to be pretty. I'm not saying go out there, make a beautiful hardback book that you're going to print and send 5 copies off to your players. It can be a Word document. It can be, you know, with no color. It doesn't have to have graphics and images. It just needs to be functional. You know, if we were talking about creating a second guide to release for your setting for DMs to read and run a game in, then maybe you need to start thinking about the way it looks and stuff like that. You know, it's a product at that point. This isn't a product. This is something that you're going to give to your players. If you want to take the effort and put in images and, you know, have nice font and stuff, that's lovely. And your players are going to love that. But I want to put out front first, because I'm one of those people. I'll be like, it's got to look right if I'm giving it to people. It doesn't have to. It needs to be functional. It doesn't have to be perfect. And it's important to remember that, because world building gets into that point where you build a world for so long and then you never want anyone to play in it because it's not quite right. You can get the same place with a player guide. So just, I've said my piece. It doesn't have to be perfect.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And headers go a long way towards making something look professional and be very practical to use. Most programs will pick out your headers and create a table of contents automatically. That's easy to navigate. So it's as simple as like a Google Doc a lot of the time. And with a Google Doc, your players can actually like make suggestions and stuff, and people can collaborate on that handout. So yeah, definitely. You can definitely go for scrappy. Especially with like a first draft.
100%. So I have in my hands the player guide for Odyssey of the Dragonlords, because I think it's a really good kind of benchmark to look at. And I just want to break down that. I'm going to tell you how they've broken down their contents, because I think that's a good idea of how you would set this up. So they've got a preface in there because it's a new setting guide and they're a company and they're saying, hey, thanks for buying our book. We don't need that. Unless you want to be hey, thanks for playing my game. If you want to do that, do that. You've probably already said it in session 0. Chapter 1 is, for them, the world of Thylia. So this is their world. So they have the history, they have how you travel, the powers being gods, the mortal kingdoms, so the kingdoms that you need to know, the laws, and then the myths. This is Odyssey is a Greek kind of style, so myths are a big important thing. So for you, that could be like, you know, you're going to play Spelljammer and you want to tell people about the myth of the Spelljammer, so that, because everybody knows that. That would be myths.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 2 is then creating heroes. Now, bear in mind that this is a setting guide that gives different races, and they also have subclasses. So for you, that would be stuff like, okay, you want to create a roguey gang member? Here are some of the gangs you might want to think about. You want to play a paladin? Here are some of the churches in this area of the world that you'd want to think about. You want to play a wizard? Here are some of the schools or the magic shops that you would frequent. Here's like the day-to-day stuff that your character would know if you're playing this kind of class. So for me, that would be break down things like, here are the races that are prevalent. Here are the names that come up a lot, like the naming structure, if you want to go that deep. Here's the class-by-class kind of general stuff that they would know. So a wizard would know that it's really hard to get magic supplies in this area of the world, and so you'd have to travel to the city once a month. You know, stuff like that. And then saying like which city that would be. It doesn't have to be massively detailed, but it can be.
I think this is also an interesting place to maybe talk about whether or not all of the classes are in your mm-hmm. setting. I went to a hobby shop and looked around for like an hour and then felt bad that I had looked around for an hour. So decided that I had to buy something. So I bought a copy of The Lost Citadel, which mm-hmm. is a different setting guide, very different in tone. And in their version of this, they basically say, hey, all of the primary spell casting classes are out. Like you shouldn't / can't play them in this setting, which I thought was very interesting and is something that we talked about a little bit, I think, in our Sword and Sorcery episode.
That's one of those things that really ties into like what kind of world you're playing, what kind of tone you're going for.
This is a great place to tell your players, not just, hey, this is what is more about my world. Like there are these extra available races and classes. It's a place to say, this is what's different or not existent in my world that you might be expecting. And that might not appeal to all players, which is a great thing to work out before you actually start playing the game.
Yeah, I think like that should have come up in the session zero. Like you would have said, okay, by the way, these classes aren't available and why will be specifically stated in the player guide that I'm going to send you now so that you can read it. So you put it out there and then you back up why. And you know, there are going to be people who are listening to this and going, oh, I don't want to play a game where classes aren't available. That's fine. There are going to be people that want it. There'll be people that don't want it. If you're one of those people that want to say no wizards, then this is where you would do it.
It's definitely very niche. I think it's a thing that people typically reach for after they've played in the kind of default fantasy land, like a few times, and they're looking for something different and they'll do whatever is necessary to get that different flavor.
Yeah. This Creating Heroes chapter is also the place where you would list any backgrounds that maybe you've made for your world. You know, you probably got the standard ones from the PHB, but if you've got a specific one, or maybe you've altered what's one of the ones I'm thinking of, like soldier, maybe you've said, okay, the soldier background specifically means you would have worked in this army for this person. Mm-hmm. And so you would write that out. If you've got things like different weapons, like you might say for example, Thalia being Greek, there's lots of like Greek style Odyssey weapons. Like you might list that there. Things like that.
Yeah.
Then, so for this player guide, they have playable races. And I think if you're not giving new playable races, this doesn't necessarily have to be its own chapter. It could go on the end of the last chapter, but this is a good place to say, hey, in my world, there aren't any Loxodon. There aren't elephant people. You know, that's a bit not fitting the theme. So it's important to set, and that's a restriction, to set that restriction. And it's interesting, I think that kind of restriction is much more common than, oh, hey, this class isn't allowed. Saying, oh yeah, you can't play an Arakokra is much more common than saying, yeah, you can't play a rogue.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think it's interesting that someone might think it's ridiculous to not allow some type of playable race, or think that it's ridiculous to not allow a playable class that appears in the player's handbook, but then they see disallowed races and they're like, oh yeah, that makes total sense.
yeah it's just interesting how we all break that down in our minds.
It's almost just like kind of the cultural expectations that have like formed naturally around the hobby, which I'm fascinated by, but that's an entirely different episode.
Well, yeah, definitely. We'd be talking for hours. Thalia then has the class archetypes, which are the subclasses. Obviously, it's unlikely you're going to be bringing in new subclasses unless you're a designer who does that. But they do then list new spells. If you're bringing in new spells, maybe you've updated some from an older setting. For example, when I set up the guys for the Cosmic Causeway for Spelljammer, I had to say, hey, by the way, there are some of these are spells that are Spelljammer specific spells that I've updated to 5e. So just read through them. They're probably going to come up at some point through the game. And I think you see that in the latest episode of Cosmic Causeway. James's character sits down in a helm. He's a wizard. He learns how to pilot a ship, kind of, and he learns the spell Pilot Helm.
Spoilers, to channel his magic. Ben,
Well, I think it's out there already. If it's not, it will be in the next episode. So there you go. There's a spoiler, but it's a very minimal one.
It's a teaser. It's a teaser.
That's a good word. Yeah. So that's a place to do that. But then the next section of this book, and this is the bit where you're probably going to put more meat, they've done three chapters. One of them is The Oath of the Dragon Lord, The World Primer, and then What is Mythic Heroism? And those are very specific to this setting, right? The Oath of the Dragon Lord is a very specific setting thing for Odyssey of the Dragon Lords. It's in the title. So you might not have a section like that. That might be your creation myth, but the World Primer is very important. And that's where you say, okay, here's the pantheon. Here's the gods and what they all stand for. Here's the current kingdoms. Here's the current feeling about those kingdoms. Here's what your character, having been born in the last couple of decades, knows from living in the world. Here is the current history, whereas the start of the book was the history.
Yeah, Anna, they just really nailed that whole Kickstarter. The Dragon Lords. And I think they're coming out. They're coming out with a new Kickstarter. I think
it's out now. It's finishing. As we speak, it's got like a day left.
I'm excited. Oh yeah. Oh, there's only a day left to pledge.
It is something. Hang on, I've been getting emails. I'll tell you.
I gotta get in on that. Thanks
see,
for
I kind of do want to get in on it, but I got in on Dragon Lords and I still haven't run it yet. And I know that you can still buy Dragon Lords and all of the stuff. So I might just wait because it's been backed.
That's a good point. All right.
Oh, no. I mean, if you want it, man, you jump in on it.
You persuaded me not to. It's too late.
I can't actually find.
Your argument against was just so reasonable. That
bollocks.
I can't find it in myself to do it.
I can't find the last email I got as one of their backers, but
that's okay.
It's another Dragon Lords, but it's in a different setting and it's like a new adventure and it's new races. Yeah, it's the same thing, but different.
It's like a plane chase thing, I think, right? It's a bunch of different planes.
I don't think so, but I could be wrong.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry if that was wrong.
I know I could be wrong because I only looked at it once or twice.
Don't worry about it. I'm just so impressed by their pamphlet. And I think that I have become inspired to make the equivalent for my setting, because I think that's just going to make the next test session of like, hey, is Ray's setting a good setting? Just that much like better.
It's a really good benchmark to have a look at.
Yeah, template.
I'm so annoyed that I can't remember what Arcanum World's new project is that I'm actually looking for it right now. Hang on.
it's gonna be okay, man.
I'm gonna find it.
I think that this conversation about settings and setting guides is one that I've been giving a lot of thought to, because by virtue of like just the work I've been doing on my own setting. And I think it dovetails into a different conversation that kind of maybe will help people.
I've got it.
Oh,
sorry. Keep going.
I found it. That will maybe help people frame like when they might do this and versus when they might not. I think so. The way that I've been thinking about this is your players exist on a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, they have no meta knowledge or no knowledge about the setting, and they're kind of just showing up to play a board game in some ways. So like when we show up to play like the D&D starter set, you're like, oh, well, I didn't do a setting guide when my players decided to play Tyranny of the Dragons or Curse of Strahd. But what you're forgetting is that all of us have this knowledge about these genres that we bring to the table with us. So when you show up to play Curse of Strahd, you are expecting gothic horror. You're bringing that meta knowledge into the world, and with that knowledge comes the creative license to make decisions about the story. You get to like be the co-author of the plot. So imagine that you're going to play Dungeons and Dragons with someone who has never played a video game before, has never read Lord of the Rings, has never watched Game of Thrones, and they're showing up kind of like thinking that this game is going to be something similar to Monopoly. They are not going to be able to effectively act as kind of like a collaborative storyteller during that first session until they gain the meta information that is necessary to like act with confidence in your world. And then on the completely opposite end of that spectrum, you have someone who's like read the campaign guide and they know, not only do they know the necessary information that's like that prerequisite information that exists in the player handbook, but they also know like the answers to the specific riddles that are going to pop up in the game. And then that player has probably gone too far in the other direction of the spectrum to be able to contribute in an effective way. Because when that riddle pops up, they basically have to excuse themselves from participating for the next like hour and a half because they don't want to ruin it for the other players. So one way to think about when you might reach for this guide to hand out to your players is when you're trying to deliberately adjust that balance of meta information that the players have coming into that first session of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about it. I have nothing to add there. I think, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Cool.
The Kickstarter has 2 hours left to go as we record. So,
oh my God.
So if you're listening to this, it's probably finished already.
Oh, no.
But it is Raiders of the Serpent Sea. So it's Odyssey of the Dragon Lords, but Norse. And it's like Vikings and Norse stuff. So there you go.
Must have been looking at the entirely wrong Kickstarter.
Maybe. Yeah. That's there cool you go. Though. So that's what that is. So it's really enticing, but I think I'll wait until it's been backed. Mm. It's got its goals. That's going to happen. So I'll probably wait for it to get released as an adventure before I get it. Cool. Well, I think you summed it up. You summed up some really good stuff there, and I think we're getting to time now. We've talked for a long time, so it's probably about time we wind up. But I think the final takeaway from me then is this is a great tool to use. Particularly for homebrew games, but also for games where they've never played in that setting or place before. And it should bolster your session zero. It doesn't have to look pretty if it's only going to your players. It just needs to be functional. That's my advice if you've never done one before as well.
Absolutely. I think that's great advice. Definitely race to create the first draft of it and get it in front of people because they will have feedback and it will save you so much time to iterate in that way rather than like trying to get it just perfect before you show it to that first person.
Mm. Awesome. Ray, thank you very much for joining me today.
It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely. As ever, if you want to get involved with the show, if you want to tell us what you think, send in any ideas, any topics, We Speak Common on Twitter, We Speak Common Pod on Facebook, where We Speak Common on Instagram as well. And right now we have a listener feedback survey out. I think it's out for another week from now. I would absolutely love your feedback. If you are a regular listener of the show, tell us what you think. Takes about 2 minutes to fill out. It's not very long and it helps you shape the future of the network. So go check that out. It's a pinned tweet on Twitter. It's also been posted on Facebook, so you can find it in both of those places. If you want to get in touch in any other way, wespeakcommon@hotmail.com is the email. And if you want to support the show, the best way to do it is via Patreon. We have a wonderful Discord community of people who sit and chat and talk D&D and just life. I've made some incredible friends through that community. If you want to come and join us there, that's what we're building. We're building a wonderful D&D storytelling community over on Discord. And the way to get to it is through the Patreon, which you'll find available on all of the social medias. Cool. That's it. We're done. Let's wrap it up. Thank you very much, Ray.
Absolutely, Ben.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, do us a favor and share us with a friend or a D&D group near you. If you'd like to directly support We Speak Common, you can by heading to the links in the description, either on this episode or via our social medias, to find our Patreon. It's the best way to directly support the production of more shows like the one you listened to today. You can connect with the show on Twitter and Instagram at We Speak Common. The music in the episode is Street Dancing by Timecrawler82 and is held under a Creative Commons 4.0 license. You can find it on the Free Music Archive.